Welcome to M&I's FedSpeak podcast. I'm Pedro DaCosta, and I'm very happy to welcome Kevin Warsh to the program. Kevin served as Fed governor from 2006 through 2011 and was the board's representative to the G20 at the time. From 2002 to 2006, he was special assistant to the president for economic policy and executive secretary of the White House's National Economic Council. He is now a fellow at the Hoover Institution, an advisor to the Duquesne Family Office, and serves on UPS's board of directors. Thank you so much for joining FedSpeak today.
Hey, Pedro, thanks very much. It's good to reconnect with you. It's been a long time since we were in a war together, back on your old beat and mine, and it's a pleasure to be on your podcast.
Absolutely. So I wanted to start with the news this week. We had a CPI report that came in a little bit hotter than expected and seemed to halt kind of this continued progress that the Fed is looking for as they think about cutting interest rates. How concerning was this week's reading to you, and how does it affect the path of policy in your view?
Pedro, maybe because I'm an old timer, I'm not that interested in this monthly view of inflation. I don't think the data is that good. I don't think the Fed should be that dependent on it. I think there's been a preoccupation over the last several years with this sort of data, which is all well to the right of the decimal point, which is how we got into this mess. I'm happy to focus on that. But my sense is both markets and, most important, central bankers are way too preoccupied with these 3 and 6 month moving averages. The truth is that the price of every good in this economy and every service in the economy changes because of decisions that are often narrow, that have to do with a whole bunch of things. That's the equivalent of the weather. The Fed should be focused on the climate. What's the broad constellation in changes in the economy that matter to them? And this preoccupation with, oh, I wonder what rents are doing this month. I wonder what's happened to supply chains because of problems in the Red Sea. It shows a preoccupation with a bunch of data that I don't think really goes to the core question of inflation.
So what is the state of inflation in your view? Is inflation still high, and are the risks still tilted to the upside?
Yeah, so I think if you step back, if you look at the components of prices in the U.S. economy, still more than a third of the components of even the CPI data, which came out earlier this week, which we referenced, more than a third of those are running above 5%. And that ratio is materially higher than was the case pre-COVID. And frankly, is a higher percentage of prices running above 5% than was true in 2023. So remember, we're trying to figure out what's the broad change in the constellation of prices. Is that converging on the Fed's vaunted 2% goal? Doesn't look like it is to me. And so the Fed, I think, finds themselves in a tricky spot. On the one hand, they don't use the T word transitory anymore. But I hear from Fed officials, including Chairman Powell, references to supply chains. Well, supply chain is just a new modern word for, yeah, it really was transitory. It's not how I think about inflation. Inflation is a choice. Inflation is set by the world's central banks. The central bank isn't a victim to prices. The central bank sets the broad constellation of prices. And so I think one quibble I have with the broad conduct of policy at the Fed is this seeming unwillingness to take responsibility for it, to pass it off on others. And the second judgment that I've got, which again maybe dates me, is I don't think they've got the right intellectual model about what drives inflation. You know, in some sense, the model that's been dominant at the Fed now for 40 years is, you know, if workers get too much money, the compensation goes up too much, then we have inflation. That might have been how the wage price spiral was in the 1970s. That is not my view of how it works. I don't think an economy that's moving strongly, that's paying workers, is inherently inflationary. So to just see if I could state it more simply, I think that inflation and output, or inflation and employment, are much more independent variables than the leading lights in the profession seem to believe. I don't think that there's an inherent trade-off there. And I think that's part of the reason why the Fed finds themselves trying to look for other reasons why prices are moving. Wars and supply chains are the best explanation. My own sense is they should spend the 1,000-plus PhD economists they have and go back and try to answer once and for all a very relevant question. What is inflation? What's our responsibility for it? And isn't there a better way to measure it? Absent doing that, I think we're going to find ourselves lurching from data point to data point, which I think disguises much more than it reveals.
So what should they be looking at? Is there, for instance, a fiscal component to inflation that the Fed has perhaps ignored? What are drivers, if not the labor market? And if you say that, you know, the Phillips curve is not as lively as the Fed would like it to be, in the sense that employment and inflation are not that closely tied, does that mean that you buy into the idea that we can have a soft landing, that we can kind of glide lower on inflation without much damage to employment?
So there's a lot there. Let me see if I can take that in pieces, Pedro. If I miss any of them, come back to me. One is, remember, during Chairman Greenspan's tenure, I think the language he definitely used to try to not take on the profession and the leading lights and the Fed's models is he'd say the Phillips curve is much flatter than we had once thought. So I think that's a good euphemism that's consistent with my idea that these are largely independent variables. And again, just to play that a little bit more deeply, why did wages move up markedly in the last year or two? I think it's because non-wage prices moved up first. And then employees said, hey, I'm falling behind. And they said to their employer, I can't buy the basket of goods and services I could buy before. I need a pay raise, which was understandable. You know, I happen to be on the board of UPS. I don't want to go into details about the Teamsters negotiation, but I think the Teamsters said, listen, we can't afford what we could afford before. We need more from you. I tell that story because it strikes me that the economy and inflation setting is quite different in this cycle than it was 40 or 50 years ago. And it wasn't wages that begat the increase in prices. This is more of a price wage spiral than a wage price spiral. And so wages aren't telling me anything as a forward indicator. All they were telling me was catch up. So that's a little bit of that. I think on the beginning of your question, it was really about, so does monetary and fiscal policy have more to do with it? And are they related? And remember, you know, I was a student of Milton Friedman now 30 plus years ago. So I have this old fashioned idea that monetary policy has something to do with money. Can you just imagine? Has something to do with credit. And I happen to believe that it is true that it's very difficult to manage the growth in money. It's difficult also to understand the data around the velocity. But I think money has something important to do with it. I'd say a second piece that would be a bit of a addendum to Milton's famous view that monetary policy is affected largely by money is that fiscal policy and monetary policy, whether we like it or not, Pedro, are now much more overlapping with one another. When the Federal Reserve gets in on a relatively permanent basis to buying Treasury securities, so Congress enacts new spending, the president signs the bill, the Treasury Secretary issues new debt. Over the period between, let's say, the 08-09 crisis where we created quantitative easing and the most recent period, the Fed has been a large and important buyer of those Treasury securities. Whether for good reasons or bad, monetary policy and fiscal policy as a result have much more to do with each other. So again, try to state this simply, the spending blowout over the course of the post-COVID era and the big spending, frankly, between the 08 period and the 2020 period has had an effect on inflation. As we sit here today, Pedro, we're more or less at full employment, broadly defined, yet we're running a deficit relative to GDP higher than at any point since World War II. And we're not doing it in a period of crisis, we're not doing it in a period of recession. That spending, that money that finds its way into the economy, and some of which, again, for good reasons or bad, has been monetized by the Federal Reserve. So I think fiscal policy has contributed in a negative way to the surge of inflation, because many people believe that the Fed has been, in some sense, a co-conspirator. It's a separate discussion about QE and QT and Treasury coordination. But if I could answer your question plainly, I would say the surge in spending has made the Fed's job harder, has caused to higher inflation. And as the Fed signaled what it's going to do next, I'm not surprised that as they signaled looser policy to come, the end of QT, the cutting of rates, that inflation can move up higher as market participants and businesses and households in their own subtle way have come to figure that looser policy is going to come, and that's going to lead to higher prices.
Now, you started by laying out a picture of, you know, an inflation that, without slicing and dicing it in every which way, is still fairly elevated relative to the Fed's target. Against that backdrop, do you think that the Fed, the discussion about interest rate cuts is premature, or are they right to start considering cuts based on the idea that policy will become sort of passively tighter if inflation keeps falling and nominal rates stay constant?
Yeah, there's a lot there too. First, I'd say you'll probably remember this back to discussions of more than a decade away. You know, who could be opposed to Fed transparency? And if that means the Fed is upfront with the Congress, the American people, about their roles and responsibilities and their objectives, then I'm all for that. But this idea, which only grows in momentum every year, that the Fed needs to share its latest forecasts with the dots, even between forecasts, which are already too frequent of every quarter, they need to tell you all, 17 or 18 or 19 people around the table, where's their dot, what they're going to do at the next meeting, the next three meetings, the next four meetings. I think this makes the objective, which is to get policy right, more difficult. The more we tell the world about what we're going to do, the more that financial markets react to that, and the more it's difficult for us to change our minds. Being a central banker is very difficult, especially these days, given the surge of inflation and plenty of risks around the world. And it strikes me as unuseful to the proper conduct of policy for them to be so transparent. Listen, I think Chairman Powell is very good at his press conferences. But for example, in his December 13th press conference, I guess it was, where he basically took off the Volcker mask and said, we're going to be cutting, we're going to ultimately stop shrinking the balance sheet. And he said, we've got a really soft landing coming. Now, that's my paraphrase of an hour, but I think that's what most reporters and most market participants captured from that. So markets started to price that. Financial conditions got a lot looser between then and now. Financial conditions today are basically looser than they were, Pedro, before they started raising rates. That can't be what they intended. The purpose of tighter policy, I thought, was tighter policy. So broadly speaking, Pedro, I think this persistent, frequent communication on what they're going to do in the future when they don't know for good reason, I think is deeply counterproductive. I think they would be much better served, and the conduct of policy would be better served, make their decisions when they need to make their decisions and explain them. And then if they want to talk in press conferences, if they want to talk to reporters, which is perfectly fine, They should talk about substantive issues. What's going to happen to productivity? What's the role of AI? What's happening around the world? What are the implications of war and peace? There's plenty upon which the world needs to hear their views, where they can be framing them. But constantly being in the forecasting business, I think, is deeply, deeply counterproductive. And I think it's making it harder for them to hit the price stability objectives that they purport to be targeting.
So the only reason they're having a potentially premature discussion about rate cuts is because they're having to publicly discuss their view of what's happening 6 to 12 months ahead.
Right. This is a choice that they're making. We don't know what the conduct of prices and the economy are going to be over the next 12 months. We shouldn't pretend that we do. But by signaling such dovishness, they're making it harder for them to achieve their objective. By signaling such dovishness, I think they're making their jobs more difficult. And there's a simple fix to it, but it's one that over the last year, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, the more they talk suggests that they've got to talk still more to correct views based on a data set that came out a couple of days ago, which I think is not of much actual value.
You mentioned the loosening of financial conditions, and that's a fascinating thing to me because I wonder how you measure, how you gauge how restrictive policy is. Is it by the real rate as measured by the nominal rate minus the expected rate of inflation 1 year out? Or is it actually by what financial condition indices are telling you broadly? How restrictive is policy in your view?
So not very is a short answer to your question. And just to be fair, going back some years, you've heard me be very critical when they were at interest rates of zero and inflation was surging, that they shouldn't be sitting on their hands. As a result, when they finally got it in March of 2022, I think they end up having to raise rates materially more than they would have if they had been on the case sooner. And now they find themselves in a position where the nominal interest rate, call it 5 3/8, they think now is restrictive. They think real rates are higher than they would have been or could have been. Listen, my view, which is again quite out of consensus, maybe this shows my age, my years away from these positions of some responsibility. This is really a discussion of what's the neutral rate. What's the equilibrium real interest rate? What's the equilibrium nominal interest rate the central bank needs to set? And I think Mervyn King said this a few years ago better than I could, so I'm going to plagiarize from Mervyn with your permission. R star, he says, is just a lagging variable for R. That is, this R star, the equilibrium real interest rate, isn't a rate that we could know. It's never knowable. And in some sense, you don't know it until you find it. Great models that have been built at the Federal Reserve and in the elite universities, they're useful because this is a helpful intellectual framework. I don't want to say that it's not, but we never know what the neutral rate is at any moment. It's a function of structural changes in the economy. It's a function of productivity. It's a function of not just what the Fed says the Fed funds rate is, but as we talked about before, what they're forecasting the rate's going to be, which has an effect on financial markets and market conditions. So I'm a little less enamored with this idea that we know exactly how restrictive or not the rate is. So what do we do? What's another tool that we central bankers, past and present, have? We could look out our window. We could ask ourselves, does the current constellation of Fed funds price, Fed funds rates, and futures prices in the curves, does the economy and economic conditions and financial conditions feel loose or tight? Well, they don't feel that tight to me. Financial markets are certainly not suggesting they're tight. Credit markets are quite open. You know, in some sense, the 30-year fixed rate mortgage rate, which call it in the high sixes at some level, is quite tight compared to what it was. But is it tight in actuality? Pedro, you probably know the statistic. The average interest rate on existing 30-year mortgages in the U.S. economy now is running at about 3.5% or 3.6%. So it's not tight if you have a mortgage. It's tight if you're moving cities or changing houses. So broadly speaking, even the mortgage markets broadly don't look tight. Why is that? Why is it that at a rate that we would have thought at 5.375% was a tight rate, why is it in effect not so tight? And I think that's really two reasons. One is the Fed is undermining its own tightness by talking that there's plenty of loosening to come. And the second thing is I have this other crazy view, Pedro, which is American businesses and households are smart. And during a long period of zero rates, they decide to lock in these interest rates. They didn't know the future, but they think, you know, I might as well lock it in while I can. So businesses termed out their financing. Certainly the S&P 500 did. I think the average interest rate by the top 500 or 600 companies that they're paying on a fixed rate basis is in the mid threes. As we talked about, most household borrowers locked in long-term interest rates somewhere in the mid threes. You know, there's only one group of people that didn't lock in interest rates, and that's the United States government. That's the sovereign who decided, well, rates are low and they'll stay low forever. Well, maybe that's not true. And that's part of the reason, I think, why we're asking for problems, because our government, instead of terming out financing like everyone else, is still subject to the whims of long-term interest rates much more than the rest of the economy.
Against the backdrop that you've outlined, two-part question, what should the Fed do? What would Kevin Warsh do if he were still at the board? And the second part is, what do you think they will do?
Yeah, so the second one is much more interesting to your listeners. We all have to be very careful about being in the normative business about what they should do versus seeing the group that's in power and saying, what's their reaction function? So let me try to separate those as your question kindly proffered. Normatively, I think the intellectual framework that is driving the Fed's modeling, thinking, and attitudes is in substantial need of reform. I think we can much improve upon the broad conduct of policy by asking ourselves fundamental questions. What is inflation? It strikes me as though many of the discussions that are had in the hallways of the Fed or in the Fed press conferences are about changes in price level. Much of the discussion about this inflation data we got earlier this week was the change in price level for different goods and services. That's not what inflation is. Inflation is a change in prices that would beget further changes in prices. So I think asking what is inflation, then asking, are we measuring it right? And then asking another question, which is, are we responsible for it or is it outside of our control? The Fed has a brilliant team of economic thinkers to challenge those questions. I think not only would the conduct of central bank policy be well served by those first sets of questions, but I think the broad business and household community would come to a better understanding of it. And then operationally, rather than go to each of these press conferences and have each of these speeches be about, well, as a central banker, what's your forecast? When do you expect there to be cuts? I think they should talk about a broader set of issues. I don't think they should tie their own hands behind their back. And it appears to me as part of the reason why inflation got out of control is they had pre-committed. It said, oh, we're going to be at rates at zero for all this time. So it was harder for them to do the right thing. I want it for them to be easier to do the right thing. So it's a longer discussion about broader reforms, but less forecasting, less predicting how many dots they have in the next 12 months when they can't know. And even if they knew, I'd want them to be a bit coy about that. The world is incredibly uncertain. Monetary policy is not just set in the US, but set at every other central bank. And so maybe one last reform I'd point out is You know, I know that most central banks say that the inflation in their country is unique to their country, but I don't think it's a surprise that the terminal rate, that is the rate where they've gotten policy for most of the Western economies, are mostly at around the same rate. I don't think that's a coincidence, because central bank policy, especially American central bank policy, bleeds into the world. And the rest of central bank policy finds its way into the U.S. markets through financial markets, through the import of goods and services. It strikes me that there's more learning from doing and coordinating across the central bank universe. This idea that they should make their own decisions is, of course, true. But I'm struck by the relative lack of understanding and coordination between and among them as they make their own independent decisions. So that's all in the normative business, but that's a separate podcast. On a positive basis, if the question is, what will they do? I'll just say this. This group seems like they want to cut interest rates. I don't think it matters to markets, quite frankly, whether they cut rates two or three or four or five times. What markets care about is, are they beginning an interest rate cutting cycle? And whether it takes a couple of quarters or a couple of years to get it, I don't happen to think markets care that much about it. This group wants to cut. This group thinks that they can go back to some status quo ante and get real interest rates that are barely positive, and that's the equilibrium. So I think markets figured that out around October 27th when asset prices in the U.S. started to move forcefully higher. I think it continues this morning. Markets figured out that this group wants to cut. This group believes that they're going to get back to some definition of price stability. Financial markets, I think, believe that the Fed is asymmetric. When inflation was running at 1.7%, which, by the way, sure sounded like price stability to me a few years ago, they create a brand new regime in August 2020 that says inflation at 1.7 is too far from our 2% target. We've got to move heaven and earth to get there. At the same time, on the other side, I think markets have figured out or are coming to the view that if inflation's in the high twos, that's good enough. I think that asymmetry is problematic. I think the Fed needs to address it. But broadly, I think these guys do want to cut rates. And at least as important for your listeners who are in the stock market, who are thinking about risk assets, we haven't talked about the Fed's balance sheet. But it strikes me that what the Fed is signaling is that they are getting pretty close to ending quantitative tightening. To put it simply, that they're not going to shrink their balance sheet much more beyond the summer. And in some sense, when they're loosening policy, they're going to be loosening it not just with interest rates, but potentially with their balance sheet as well. And I happen to think that that balance sheet, the Fed's imprimatur in the Treasury market, imprimatur in these market in the broad financial markets, is part of the reason why risk assets are rallying as well.
Fantastic. And final question, where does this leave inflation toward the end of the year as they take these actions? Does that mean that we're going to be potentially struggling with above target inflation for some time?
Yeah, so I just was critical for the Fed to make these forward forecasts about where things are going to be a year from now. So I should obey that, but I'm not a central banker anymore. I can share with you my view. Listen, my own view is inflation is quite likely to be well above target come Christmas time. And my view is the world central banks might be comfortable with that in ways that they'd be uncomfortable acknowledging publicly. I think that the inflation a year from now is up to the Fed. I don't think it's up to supply chains. That can change the price of goods of a particular sort. I think it's up to the Fed, and I think the Fed has shown a comfort with above target inflation. And so this inflation could prove stickier than they want. And my assessment of the data is while goods inflation is running around zero, services inflation is still running, I don't know, at around 4% or so. And the idea that you're going to get stable prices in an economy that strikes me is doing quite well in the U.S. and where money, here's that dirty old word, Pedro, where money is going to stop shrinking and start growing again in the form of interest rate cuts and potentially a higher balance sheet, I'll be surprised if they're at target come Christmas time.
Thank you so much. That was Kevin Warsh, former Fed Board Governor and fellow at the Hoover Institution. Thanks again for coming on FedSpeak.
Thanks, Pedro. Pleasure to be with you.